This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
We now bring you Thought Council because it is a Thursday morning and at 10 o'clock, that's exactly what we do. And on this Youth Month, we did say we will place a great deal of focus on youth-related issues. And today we ask how the youth can contribute to economic reform in South Africa in a space where we are told of the dire issue of unemployment. The rate has now climbed to a record high of 32.6%, and that is just the conservative definition. And youth unemployment itself knocking anywhere 70% upwards too. So this is a serious matter. And I know, like I said, we usually look at the big picture and say, what is the effect of load shedding, power blackouts on the economy, but we really had to appreciate the problems that we get impacted on as individuals, as citizens, and the personal inconvenience. But I've got a guest list of very youthful and young economists: Ntombana Mbele, independent economist; Bongani Mahlangu, economist and a PhD candidate; Busi Sbego, researcher and economist at the Institute for Economic Justice. Busi, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for making the time. Ntombana, good morning to you.
Morning. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you for making the time. Bongani, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mguni. Good morning to your listeners and fellow panelists, and thank you for the opportunity.
Absolutely a pleasure to have all three of you this morning. Perhaps, Ntombana, let me start off with you and say, just give us your appreciation of the state of economy in our country and how you see the place of young people in this economy of South Africa.
I think to start with, Mguni, I'm quite wary with using the word appreciation right now in terms of where we are
absolutely.
As an economy. You know, where we are as an economy and particularly what it means for young people. Mm. I do think that we are in a state of dire economic consequence from the actions that we have been, actively doing in South Africa, from civil society, sometimes our inaction in civil society, to the overconfidence that we have in government for them to initiate, the economic reforms that we desire and really need. And so I think, having mentioned to you, I think policy reform in this country is integral for SA's growth and for the development of young people who have the responsibility of taking this country forward.
I mean, Busi, we have been having this conversation for a while. At IEJ, you have also started initiatives to make sure that you are plugged in with young people, particularly those who are in institutions of higher learning, hosting a variety of fora and thought leadership sessions to think about these reforms. I know COVID disturbed part of that work, but where are you as from an IEJ perspective and from your perspective, Busi, where are we in making sure that the youth is starting to have a voice in helping to shift the needle in this economy that tends to frustrate you so much because the leaders are implementing austerity and they say it's not austerity?
Yeah, no, thank you for that question. I think you're right. The Institute has been working a lot around a program called Rethinking Economics for Africa and thinking about different ways of thinking about the economy, right? I think one of the critical issues we're facing as a country is economic orthodoxy, right? Economic traditions. We do this because this is what was taught at institutions of higher learning. And so, what we're seeing is a system. It's called the econocracy, which means that what we see is happening in the economy in terms of policy and design is actually being, panel feed into people from when they are students, from when you learned Economics 101, from when you learned EMS already. There were certain ways of understanding the world. You were already being trained to think of the world in a particular way, in a very orthodox way. And so what that has done is that it's shut out different ways of understanding the economy and more progressive ways of actually understanding the economy. And so I think that is one of the things that we've acknowledged, that this is systematic, not just from a policy perspective, but from the way economics is taught, from the way we learn it, from the way we then practice it. And so youth are part of the system, right? They're being taught economics in a particular way, and so then we've got particular beliefs. I don't think youth are adequately integrated into the planning of our of our economy generally, right? So what happens is that because economics is about aggregates, right? It's about neutrality. What it assumes is that the impacts are, you know, going to impact everybody the same. So youth, women, children, you know, everybody like that, which doesn't work. And that's what we talk a lot about, is that this idea of an economy that is neutral, that is of aggregate, actually does not work. And it's not how the economy works itself. And so it reflects in our planning, because our economic, you know, policies do not reflect these nuances in how women, children, you know, youth are impacted by sort of policy design and impact.
Yeah. I mean, Bongani, you know, your colleagues are defining a dire economic situation, a systemic problem. We even talk about youth unemployment and unemployment generally as being structural in nature. What do these things mean, and what needs to probably change?
So thanks. So basically, we tend also to focus just on unemployment and employment, which is problematic when analyzing the deficiencies of the labor market, because you also have to add the underemployment. I remember even once I even asked Stats SA, why do you never present any statistics or data in relation to underemployment, because it is as important when analyzing such things. And they gave me this response that I don't know even what's happening with it. But in any case,
perhaps Bongani, for the benefit of our listeners, do tell us, what do you mean by underemployment?
So basically, underemployment has its components. One would be you are not fully employed, like you're in a fixed-term contract, internship, learnership. So you don't have job security. Two, you might not be paid the market-related salary, so you might be underpaid. Three, it might be employment filtering. So basically what we have seen, more especially with graduates, is that more and more, and it's happening rightly with banks, that a bank teller today would have a degree as a minimum qualification, whereas a bank teller 6 years ago only had matric. They are doing the same thing, getting paid the same amount, but now the current bank teller, the more skills are required or more qualifications are required. So that is employment filtering, which is also a component of underemployment. So then when you want to analyze properly labor market deficiencies, you cannot just say unemployment and that's it, whereas other people are underemployed, which are then reflect as employed when data is collected. For instance, someone in a dead-end internship that will not be permanently absorbed after 12 or 25 months in some government department somewhere in Mahikeng in the Northwest is regarded as employed, whereas that person will be unemployed after a certain amount of time. So you need to understand those people as well and the struggles as well. And I think it goes to what Tubusi has said when she talks about directed policies, directed approaches. So if you do not analyze that group, then how will you come up with the measures or means to assist them? And also part of answering the broader question was that we have to look at the youth pathways. So we know that there's a linearity when it comes to pathways. So they're pretty much straight. You know, you get into a creche and then you go into primary, secondary. Fortunately, maybe you might go to a university. And then after university, then they become non-linear. So some get unemployed, some get underemployed, some choose to stay at home, some start businesses, and so forth and so on. So government does not look at these pathways. They only consider one pathway, which is the pathway to employment. And it does not work for all youth, because we all know that there is no homogeneous group in society, youth the same. There's no homogeneous youth group. So you have to divide them by race, divide them by gender, because the challenges they have, they differ because of these identity groups. So it goes back again to say, have a directed approach by understanding what each individual needs. Some people don't want to go to university. They want to be entrepreneurs. Some want to go to university. How do you ensure that you assist everyone in whatever it is that they do, but with understanding the broader picture that they must also reach a certain level that they plow back into the greatest or the fiscus. So government does not understand that, and government is not interested in listening to that, and that is why we have the problems that we experience, or some of the problems that we experience. And also, just to add this one as well, is that then you have certain youth groups of certain political organizations that manage the anger of youth in the country. So when they see that the youth are now angry and they're reaching boiling point, they come up with a march. Let's march to say Tito must go. Let's march for Buroto in a guru lane, just to anger management strategies, which is undermining the intelligence of youth in the country.
Okay, Bogadi, I hear you. Interesting one. Anger management. This is Thought Council on Thursday morning on Power Talk, and we are asking the question, how can the youth contribute to economic reform in South Africa? The line for you to dial is 0861-987-000 to talk to my guests, Busi Ntombana and Bongani. Ntombana, let me come back. You know, this idea of youth at times gets problematic because there are so many layers and so many different experiences on the grouping that we call youth. From an economy point of view, does it help for us to talk of youth, and in our minds we're really talking about people who are about what, 15 to 35?
I think it is quite important to have that definition of young people. But I think, as my panelists had already mentioned, the homogeneity of it becomes a problem because you can't then look at it in without context. So you can't look at a specific classification of young people, say, for example, our white counterparts, and, you know, anticipate that they have the same economic challenges and barriers of entry to the economic system the same way that Ntombana Mdele would have. Mm. And so that's why it becomes quite important to then speak about youth within the different specific challenges that they experience, particularly because of the economic upbringing that they come from, the economic systems that, you know, continue to be perpetuated in our society. And I think when you also look at the directed approach that my panelists have also mentioned, we can't continue to centralize, you know, development of young people only through education in a state where we understand that the absorption rate of labor is far below par. So I think the conversation of youth should also extend and should be made as mandatory and responsibility of, you know, both governments as well as the young people themselves and organized society to focus on the entrepreneurial space of South Africa. Because I think when we look at the official definitions of unemployment, which really are only there, you know, to kind of, you know, give a more of a global view, but don't really speak to the reality of South Africa. You've got 74% of young people being unemployed. Mm. Now, that is the labor active rate that should be working, that should be, you know, gearing efforts into the South African economic system. So when we continue to focus on creating a more, you know, directed effort only towards education, when you then have the reality of labor not being able to absorb those skills, the question should then become more innovative and to say, perhaps we need to focus our efforts on being a more entrepreneurial state and look at the realities and the context that South Africa is in. We've got a rural development and a large number of young people that are in the rural, you know, periphery. So do we then only assume that, you know, for them to be a part of the economic system in this country, they need to come to the cities? So there's a lot of, you know, discourse that has
And Ntombana, just as you are talking, sorry to break your thought, but just as you are talking, I am having this question in me. Is there a case to be made where you can create, you can tackle this labor absorption problem to make it much more better than before? Are there things that can be done to improve this situation?
I think things that can be done are the fact that young people themselves right now are taking the stance of creating their own employment. You see a lot of young people in the digital environment maximizing that space. So you understand that because there seems to be a ceiling in the employment capacity in this country. We don't know if the challenges are, you know, because of the greater challenges that we face from a governance point of view, the challenges of access and absorption and, you know, the underemployment and how contracts are now being, you know, kind of designed to keep a certain, you know, race and a certain caliber of individuals at a certain level where, as my colleague has rightfully mentioned, you're someone that has a master's degree and they're working at a call center. And so that really doesn't, and that sometimes becomes a requirement, and that does not logically make sense. And so young people, you know, I'm very proud to see that a lot of us are just taking our own, you know, our own lives, you know, into our own hands where we use and we explore the digital environment that is there. The challenge then becomes the access to internet and the limitations and the fact that it's not, you know, accessible to a large number of South Africans, which is therefore a requirement that needs to be, you know, a policy response from government, because the issue of spectrum has been, you know, spoken about and alluded to for years. But I think COVID made it much more apparent as to why this is a primary requirement for young people to kind of engage in the economy in a way that does not only speak to them formally seeking employment but creating employment themselves.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to come back to my panelists after this short break. This is Thought Council right here on Power Talk, and we are exploring how youth can contribute to the economic reform in South Africa. Join us on 0861 987-000.
A Subaru in Soweto.
Yes.
And a Merc in Melrose.
Absolutely.
An Audi in Alberton.
For sure.
And a Renault in Rosebank.
Definitely.
Buckies, boats and bikes.
Yes.
And I'll get the best offer.
Of course. Wherever you are, whatever you're driving, you want to get the best deal. Simply visit webuycars.co.za to find out what your vehicle is worth. We Buy Cars, the easiest way to sell your car by far.
At Telkom Business, we mean business about helping you with smarter ways of doing business. Switch to the best with our NGN products. With Telkom VoIP, you can dial up your performance with high-quality calls over the internet. Make calls away from the desk and connect to a hotspot on one device with Telkom Smart Voice. Or prefer answering business calls anywhere and from any phone? Get Telkom Virtual Number. Call 10213, visit telkombusiness.co.za or go to any Telkom shop. T's and C's apply.
You're listening to Power Talk, 9 a.m. to noon.
Indeed, and dial in on 0861-987-000. Send us a voice note on the WhatsApp line on 0833-03-7093 this morning. Busi, let me come back to you. One of the things that we are seeing a lot of are these sweeteners to young people by way of public employment programs, whether it's getting teacher assistance for 3 months, 300,000 of them, the CWP programs and other programs. Is this even an ideal situation, or it's just really that, a sweetener that reaches a few of the young people who are actually in need of employment? Busi? Okay, I can't hear Busi, so I'll bring Busi back to my team to try and see if we can get Busi on the dial. Perhaps Bongani, you can bite on that question if you heard it.
Okay, so basically, what that demonstrates from government, that spending with recruiting these EAs and so forth, and it also falls under employment as well, is that it demonstrates that government does actually have the ability to actually create employment for young people. What government does not have is the incentive. I do not know why it does not have the incentive. So what only needs to happen is that, how do you then convert these temporary job opportunities into more permanent, so it gives job security and it allows for access as well for these young people into the financial space in terms of banking, because mostly are unbanked. Mm-hmm. So it allows them to be banked, which allows them credit, and they can then consume on certain things such as houses, cars and so forth, investment, which is capital formation. And they'll also be able now to partake in the greater economy. But government does not have the incentive, but it demonstrates ability. And the same goes towards what government does with this presidential yes program. Gauteng has that TEPO 1 million program, which is basically, more especially when it comes to the presidential yes program, is basically taking what existed, which is the CETAs and the learnerships thereof, and just putting it under the president's department and passing it off as a new program, whereas it existed. And even that now, the learnership program was problematic in itself, because that comes from your national skills plan, which is guided by your Skills Development Act, which is guided, also is funded by the Skills Levies Act. What they do is they take young people, put them in companies. They are not properly or adequately trained, and supposedly they are generating certain skills there that would allow them to compete properly in the labor market, which is not happening. So these companies or skills providers, what they do is they give government at the end of the year, every year, the annual training reports, which government, it's the Department of Higher Education and Training that's the custodian of all these things. They do not follow up to say, did these young people actually generate that specific skill? So they take it as it is, these training reports, annual training reports from the skills provided, without actually checking. And then 12 months when the learnership now has been exhausted, you find that the young person does not have those skills. But then there's a tick box where government says that we created that 600,000 jobs, like EAs, we created 300,000 jobs, or say they don't even use jobs anymore. They use the word opportunities. We created 300,000 opportunities for young people. Yeah. So now, and if you look into the quality of the program, there's zero or poor quality. If you look into the quantity, because that's what they are concerned with, they're politicians, that's what they are concerned with. So now, if we look into all these things, they can be addressed. Firstly, there has to be accountability. I mean, even the money that is used for this presidential yes program or the CITAS program, yeah, it's money that comes straight from industry. So it does not come from the fiscus. It's not a fiscus allocation. It does not come from taxpayers. But then government is not using it for the purpose that it's intended for. And that is why young people still don't have skills with these great pieces of legislation, great programs. So until government really develops the ability, I mean the incentive to do these things, nothing will change. And in order to ensure that you provoke a catalyst for government to develop that incentive, I think maybe talking to government might not be assist. We have to take to the streets.
Let me go back to Busi. Before we go to the streets, Busi, I mean, Bongani raises something that always bothers me, the change in terminology. It's now work opportunities, and the distinction between jobs and work. Government people will tell you a lot of things, and the fact that we're now focusing on opportunities, what stops the private sector from also saying, well, we will just find where the opportunities are, rather than having a serious commitment to create, to job creation? How serious is this terminology situation?
No, thank you for that. And earlier when you asked me the question and you
yes,
couldn't hear me, this was one of the things I was going to raise, this issue of opportunities for jobs. And to say that, you know, There's definitely a role for government to be...
Busi, can you get closer to your mic? I think you might be a bit distant.
Okay, let me try. Can you
hear
me
better
now?
That's better.
Okay. I was saying that I think there's certainly a role for government to play as an employer. And sometimes, you know, the program's employer of last resort and so forth. But remember again that one of the problems that we're facing in our country is this issue of, or what has been made into an issue, the size of the public sector wage bill, right? Mm. And so what that does, it actually stands in this way to say that how can we argue for a government that is an employer of last resort when at the same time there are arguments that the public sector wage bill itself is too large? And so this always comes back to this question of what is the role of the state? And to me, that's one of the questions that is very critical that we answer as a country, to say that in the absence of private sector creating the jobs that we need in our country, I think our government can certainly play a very prominent role in creating work. I mean, you look outside the road or outside your house, you can see that there's work that needs to be done, right? Mm. You can see that potholes need to be fixed. You can see that, you know, we don't have the adequate infrastructure. So there's many work opportunities in our country that need to be created. But what we ultimately need is an interventionist state, a state that says, this is what we need for our economic development, and we're going to create those jobs in this way or another, and we're going to make that work, you know, happen in our country. And I think part of it is that lack of...
Okay, please hold that thought. Please hold that thought. I need to go to news headlines, but I'll come back to you and we try and ventilate what this interventionist state is, because some people say get the state out of business, but it's time for Power News Headlines.
Power Talk with Lukhona Mnguni, weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Power 98.7.
Indeed, now we are talking. It is 26 minutes to 11. I have my guest, Busi Sibeko, Ntombana Mbele, Bongani Mahlangu, as we dissect, you know, during this youth month, the place of youth and the state of the economy, really, and how we imagine young people in this economy. What needs to change? What needs to be reformed? Busi, you were still talking about the idea of an interventionist state. It's a very contentious issue, depending where you are ideologically in the political economy spectrum. In your mind, what would an interventionist state in South Africa look like?
Yes, when you're right to point that out, this ideological difference, I wanted to start off though, as we're thinking about this, is to say you have to remember that the current budget that we are seeing is not just a technical exercise, but a political one, right?
Yeah.
Austerity has been used to legitimize a desire to shrink the social welfare role of the state, deregulate labor markets, emphasize private markets as the driver of growth, which is what we are seeing currently, right? Mm. But austerity also enables the reconfiguration in the interests of capital. particularly the financial sector. So to me, the role of the state, and this is not to dichotomize it, to say that, you know, private sector, you know, must be the one forward, or the state must be the one that leads everything. But to say that fundamentally what I think is missing in South Africa is the developmental state agenda, right? To say that this is the economy we want, and we are going to invest in labor-intensive industries because we need employment in our country. And this is the role of the state, to invest in these sectors that are going to generate employment. We as a state care about the social and productive work that is done by women to reproduce the labor of this country. So we're going to invest in early childhood development centers. We're going to invest in the care economy so that we are, you know, creating a particular type of labor force. And then we're going to compensate and value women's work, right? So to me, this idea of an interventionist state is one that is very intentional about resolving the issues of our country and not just playing this role, which is our state is doing, is playing an enabling role for private sector to basically deliver on its promises. So to me, reducing and shrinking the state will not solve our problems, right? Private sector has its own, you know, interests, its own outcomes, what they want for themselves. And so we cannot assume that private sector will step in. They haven't, right? Since 1994, if private sector was going to solve South Africa's problems, we'd be in a very different place right now. So I think the state has to play a real role in regulating the private sector, particularly excessive wealth. Yeah. You know, in our country generally. So those are some of the ideas I have of what an interventionist state looks like. Absolutely. It is one that is very intentional, has clear theories of change. We are creating this policy because this is an outcome we expect, and one that doesn't sit back and rely on the private sector to, you know, to resolve.
Okay. And Domana, just listen in. I've got some questions on Twitter. Lorato says, I must ask my guests to share views on the youth wage subsidy, the progress update, and some international case studies of where it benefited young people. There's another question that I also want to read out so that you respond to both of these questions. Muzik is saying, your panelists are missing one crucial thing. South Africa's labor market is moving from underemployment to involuntary unemployment. When it comes to entrepreneurship, very few will make it because our system is rigged to favor the connected. And Domana, I'll give you a chance to respond to those two.
Okay, I think before I do respond to the Twitter comments, I just want to also emphasize on the fact that the issue of having a very privatized state is that the nature of the oligopolistic and monopolistic environment that we exist and that we have in South Africa is problematic. We can't have four major banks that have, also in inception, were quite discretionary in nature as to who they are going to fund, for what they're going to provide funding for. And so that also continues to become an issue that we should really, on a policy level, be able to discuss rigorously in this country. Secondly, when you look at the incentive that governments, or what would incentivize governments to assist young people more, is the fact that young people right now are the critical mass, firstly. And secondly, we really have the electoral power to decide who we have in power and who we entrust with our votes. And I think it's critical that, you know, in this youth month and in these kind of discussions, we reiterate that to young people that, yes, the statistics are really not for us, and we are not really confident in the governance that we have right now. Who has the power to change that is something that we really need to believe that we have and actually put it into effect. Now, in answering the youth wage subsidy, I think, you know, when it comes to the youth wage subsidy, it's also quite a very, policy-centric thing that these companies will leverage on, but will not really yield to a more sustained employment opportunity for a young person or them getting a sustained job. So as Bongani had alluded to earlier, you find that they give you a nice 18-month contract, and then they put on record that, okay, as part of the youth wage subsidy, we have, you know, a certain number of young people, you know, under this kind of demographic, and so they fit the mandate, and we are paying them the wage that is stipulated in this policy. But if it's sustained, does it yield to me being able to continuously be an economic participant in this economy? Does it yield to real, you know, me earning a real wage that is competitive to my global counterpart? That's not really the reality in South Africa. And so that's why, even with the huge wage subsidy, consultation has to be done with young people. There are so many organizations that will be able to give you rigorous data that will show the effect, the lack effect thereof, of the wage subsidies. And so how far they've missed the mark. But I think when government continues just to engage with themselves and rework these models in a way that is not quantified by data and data that is in the market, I think it just becomes disingenuous.
Yeah. Bongani, you had those two questions as well.
All right. No, thanks. The first question is that with the huge wage subsidy, it's the same as what I said with regards to the Skills Levies Act. Mm. It is used by industry or the labor market to generate more returns for them, more especially in the private sector, because with the huge wage subsidies, basically the company would generate rebates for taking on a specific number of youths for whatever the conditions that may be. And then with those rebates, that means they pay less with regards to tax. So then their tax liability is reduced by government. So what then they do is they would even take up these youths, but then not use them adequately.
Yeah.
And at times not even use them for a significant lifespan, because, you know, labor is sold. So it would probably
even give them the appropriate skill by
exactly,
by way of
which links to what I said earlier, is that they do not give them the adequate skills when they are there. But then the same companies, they do submit reports to government that skills are being given. But government does not take it upon themselves to actually check, fact check, if actually this thing is happening on the ground. I know a lot of youth that have never been approached, who are on this program, that have never been approached by government to say, do you understand this? Were you taught this? They are always asking the service or the skills provider. That then now with that, with government being unable to actually oversee these programs, then these things happen where now I provide skills so I can cut on my tax burden, and that increases my revenue. But then on the other end, or the end user, which is this youth that has to have the skills, that has to be competitive in the labor market, they are robbed. So they are robbed broad daylight, and government doesn't do much about it. And then that's why I do not fully agree with those things. And then the second one, involuntary unemployment. Unfortunately, that is the case, because I think Nobu touched on it. We have a government that is not really clear on what its priorities are. For example, you'd find that 600 million in the last midterm budget policy statement was put aside to employ early childhood teachers or educators or practitioners and social workers. The same government comes back later and reduces about 250 billion rand from the baseline of government, and then it also reduces a significant amount of billions from the social SASSA, the ministry under Ulindi Wezulu, which is supposed to be getting that 600 million for the social workers, and also education is being reduced, which is supposed to be handling that project of early childhood development. So now, then those are diminishing returns, because the impact now is not felt anymore. Mm. So the same government says this on one hand, but the same government says the other on one hand. And as you said, they do not call it austerity or fiscal consolidation. In fact, they call it refocusing of spending. And if you look into Tito Mboweni's performance agreement, fiscal consolidation is just part one. But in fact, his entire leadership since he got into office is just to focus on that one item. And there has not been any refocusing of spending. There is no synergy between monetary and fiscal policy in South Africa. And as a result, we are seeing what we are seeing now. Jobs are being lost. And equally, in the long run, we cannot only focus on labor-intensive projects. Yes, they are good now, but you'd expect South Africa, the most advanced economy in Africa, to be now in the capital-intensive space. But we're still in the labor-intensive space, and our labor market or our labor force is not adequately skilled. That is why when there are shocks into the economy, such as COVID-19, we experience this high unemployment because of the labor-intensivity of our economy.
Yeah.
So with government not funding enough when it comes to education and students having to strike every beginning of an academic year, it will remain in the labor-intensive economy. We'll not move to a capital-intensive economy like your developed economies. That is why when they are hit by shocks like COVID, they are simply able to say to their labor force, go and work at home. So okay, it doesn't really affect production and output, and it doesn't really impact on employment in those countries.
This is Thought Council right here on Power 98.7, and we are talking about the youth and the economy of our country. My guests are economists Bongani Mahlangu, Ntombana Mbele, Busi Sbeko. And Busi, I'm going to read two questions, and this, part one of it ties up to Bongani's parting shot. Mr. Sirius says, I must ask, how has the influence of immigrants affected the labor market in South Africa, especially for the youth? So that would be one. And Ziggy says there is a huge problem with education levels in South Africa. Youth need to be educated more. How do you respond to those two?
Yeah, I'll start with the second, which is on education, which is one of the sectors, at least, that I look at closely, to say that our government has been systematically underfunding education for the last decade. So, in fact, what they're spending now per student is less than what they should be. It hasn't been inflation adjusted, right, in the way that it should, considering as well population growth. So this has been like sort of happening in the background silently, right, over time that they're underfunding the sector. But also it's interesting to me because the NDP and, you know, the latest conversations around that focus so much on education. Yet what you actually see is that over the next 3 years, there's going to be rapid or accelerated cuts in the education space. And in fact, you know, in the latest budget 2021, the National Treasury acknowledges that the cuts to the compensation bill, which is obviously the teachers and so forth, is going to have negative ramifications for no fee paying schools.
Yeah.
So they explicitly acknowledge that these cuts to the public sector wage bill are going to, you know, disproportionately impact poor learners. And I actually think that is deeply unconstitutional in our country where we've got the right to education. Mm. But also, of course, education has got a lot of other issues that have to be considered. I mean, on the one hand, we are fighting for, you know, toilets so that schools don't have pit latrines. And on the other hand, we need to be fighting for curriculum, right, that responds to what economy are we building. Again, this goes back to economic planning. Does our educational system reflect the economy we're trying to go towards? In fact, what is the economy we're trying to build? I'm not clear that government is clear on where we're actually going and what kind of labor force we want to accompany that, right? So this goes to a bigger issue of economic planning. I think in terms of immigrants and so forth, is to say that I think we need to think about the larger system, right? The system is not that immigrants are here taking jobs in South Africa. The issue in South Africa is that unemployment is structural and it's cyclical, which means that our economy itself is not producing enough jobs. You know, never mind immigrants, never mind, it's not producing enough jobs to even absorb the South Africans who want to work. And on the other end is that we have demand deficiency, which means that we are poor. And because we are poor, we are unable, you know, to buy and invest in our economy to make it grow. So it's a two-way thing, which means that actually to resolve this, we need like a pro-employment macroeconomic policy that looks at the social protection side. You know, the social, we need to think differently about grants, for example. We need to look at the sectoral policies and we need to look at the labor market policies themselves. And so because we do not have this coordinated pro-employment macroeconomic policy, we'll always have this thing being raised of that immigrants are taking jobs, that immigrants are taking jobs, whereas there are no jobs. And in fact, our economy generally is good.
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. I'm going to come back after a short ad break, Ntombana, and put the question that Makotwa has written to me on Twitter, saying that small businesses are the real job creators. I run an architectural firm and I run an apprenticeship program, a pay skills levy and UIF. I've never had any tax rebates and even TERS didn't pay my workers. All these programs benefit big businesses. That is something that we'll pick up on after this short ad break.
Tweet Lukhona at Lukhona Mguni and hashtag Power Talk.
Indeed, also call in on 0861-987-000 if you want to be part of this conversation. But indeed, keep those tweets coming at, you know, at Lukhona Mguni and hashtag Power Talk. This is the Thought Council, and we have economists dealing with, you know, issues around the economy, needs for reform, and the state of youth. And Ntombana, you had that question from Makotwa.
Yes, I did. And I think, you know, when you look at the issue of small businesses in South Africa, you look at, for example, with COVID Relief Fund, which was intended of appropriating $14 billion towards assisting small businesses to recover from the COVID shock. And it's interesting to see that, you know, when you look at the small business enterprise finance agency, they only approved 513 million rands from the approved 14 billion. And so that already screams red tape. It screams that there either something that small businesses is not in regulatory terms, like nullifies them from getting that kind of financial assistance.
Yes.
Or the issue becomes that the red tape itself is exclusionary. And so, therefore, it becomes a question of small businesses that don't have historical collateral, like, you know, the major businesses that are in, you know, these oligopolistic, organizations. How then do they get the support that is necessary for them to have a going concern? And so, you know, if you're not really getting financing from the private sector and the government itself doesn't really give you enough access or create an environment that provides you with access to funding, it really does not assist with the one employment crisis that we have in this country and with the bigger growth prospect that we have. So I really think that when you have the conversation of small businesses is one that should be taken with much more vigor, and one that, like, I think they should just be accountable. They should be telling small businesses, why is it that there's still over 13 million that is still available? Only the traction was only around 16% in total. So why is that? You know, so that I think is the biggest question around small businesses and access to funding for small businesses and the support.
Absolutely. Bongani, I mean, we often come across these issues that Ntombana is raising. Here we have monopolies, oligopolies, and all of these big terms that really get us to know that the economy is concentrated in each and every sector around a few companies, four in some instances, five in some, whether you are in the accounting field, in the legal field, and so on. What have we done, or what have we not done, to break up these monopolies? And I know we hear this speech after speech, we must break the hold of monopolies. The Competition Commission trying to do that with some of its work. The president mentions this in his State of the Nation addresses, but I don't seem to be seeing enough movement in this regard. What needs to happen?
No, thanks for that. So we do know that the South African economy is characterized by high concentration almost in every sector of the economy. And yes, we do have the Competition Commission, or now the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. But then when it comes to the Competition Commission, it does do a good job. But then the Competition Commission is not adequately funded. If you look at it, I think the last time they had a headcount of about 200. And then from those 200, it was evenly divided between lawyers and economists. And then those people are supposed to be the people then that ensure that there is access to markets, the removal of barriers of access, be it perceived or real. And they just don't have enough resources to ensure that happens. On the other end, you have a government that doesn't really assist, more especially small businesses, to be able to penetrate the market. We can take farming, for example. You can farm, but then how do you ensure that your goods move from the farm to the market and are able to compete with other goods in the market? It's difficult, and there's no assistance in that space. Even if you look into the township economy currently, the retail, the grocery retail, space in the township economy.
Yeah.
It's either held by non-South Africans, but then we have seen government now funding big retailers, big brands in the name of Pick and Pay and ShopRite to enter the retail market of the township economy.
And they're even putting up quasi spaza shops type of things, and mobile spaza shops. Why is that mobile, even allowed?
Exactly, these nice things that they are doing. And now that budget, that amount could have been used to assist small businesses. Either you group them, you give them the necessary expertise, necessary funding, so they can reclaim that sector, and they can actually grow, and you can even develop them into a major retailer that now they enter the space and are able to break up this concentration that we have seen in the market for quite some time. But it goes back to what I said earlier. We do not know, and I think Obusi touched on it as well, we do not know what the priorities of this government are. And maybe that speaks to administrative instability, our leadership instability, and policy instability, and maybe also the issue of ideology as well. well, because maybe that is why we don't know. So there are so many missed opportunities that government could have assisted, or government can assist small businesses. But as far as the Competition Commission is concerned, I'll be the first one to protect them.
Yeah.
They are trying their level best, but then they are not getting the adequate assistance from government. Yes, we have heard the president talk about breaking monopolies, breaking oligopolies, ensuring that the barriers of access are removed. But I can tell you in real terms, practically, on the ground, that is not happening. It's just nice speeches from our president.
Absolutely. Busi, I mean, on the question around supporting youth initiatives, Donald Africa says on Twitter, they talk about youth empowerment, but they do nothing to help youth initiatives. Where is Nkosana Makati? That's Mr. Please Call Me. But I mean, on this issue, we don't find, there's a cry perhaps that there isn't enough support for youth initiatives. I mean, I had a caller earlier today from Bankop, if I'm not mistaken, who said to me he lost a job during COVID, started broiler farming, now there is load shedding, power blackouts. They affect him because if you are in the breeding season, you can lose your chicks if you have lost electricity for just an hour. But I don't think in government there's anybody trying to think what can be done for a person like that in the midst of these continuous rolling blackouts.
Absolutely. I mean, again, I go back to this issue of our government responses are not intersectional. Actually, I didn't use that word earlier, but to say that we need to think along intersections. What does it mean? I mean, I say unemployment in our country is obviously black. It is young. It is a woman, most likely in the Eastern Cape or Limpopo, right? Like that's, there's a geography, there's a race, there's a gender. There's so many other intersections that I could have included there. Maybe it's a person living with disability, you know, and because our economic policies and generally do not speak to these intersecting oppressions and exploitations, right? We can't have policy that speaks to those people because then, you know, it's neutral, right? You create neutral policies in hopes that it works, in hopes that it positively impacts the majority. But that's not how it works. Economic policy has to be specific. It has to be general, but it also has to be very specific. And I think we need to move towards more targeting. I think it was Ben Fine who said ESCOM is an indicator that South Africa has failed as a developmental state. Mm. And that is where we are, right? This load shedding conversation is to say that why is it? In any state, the first interest should be how do we secure electricity? I mean, beyond everything else, if our state fails to secure security, which is such a big component of our economy itself, right? How do you generate, produce without electricity? Then, you know, our expectations for other things must also be lower because, you know, but just to finalize here to say, I think one of the things youth have to do more of is to hold our state accountable. Yeah. I think that fundamentally what will be a game shifter in our country is when youth stand up, and not just youth, women, you know, men, everybody stands up and holds our government accountable to say that this is what our expectations are of you. Why are you not delivering? Why is there load shedding? You know what I mean? Why is there this? And I don't think they account enough for their failures. I think there's a real space here for accountability that needs to be explored deeply by the youth.
Absolutely. My guests were Busi Sibeko and Ntombana Mbele and Bongani Mahlangu. I must thank you so much for coming on Power Talk this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That brings Thought Council to an end. And of course, we will continue to bring you many more conversations as we go along.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.